All right, good morning, everyone. It's 9:30. Let's go on the record, please. Before we resume with questions from commissioners for the Duke witness panel, I will ask if there are any preliminary procedural matters or other housekeeping issues for my attention this morning. Anything from you, Mr. Robinson?
Not HR Mitchell.
Okay, sounds good. All right, well, before we get started, I do have a request to Duke for some late filed information. This is coming from commission staff, so I'm going to read the request so that I don't, so that I get it right. All right, so we would like for the company to provide in a late filed exhibit the total annual revenue requirement requested by DEC in this proceeding related to the recovery of the deferred CCR costs allowed by the commission in docket number E7 sub 1146. And in that late filed exhibit, it would be helpful to us if you would provide citations to DEC's testimony and exhibits in this proceeding showing the calculation of this total annual revenue requirement and include the total North Carolina retail amount of deferred CCR costs allowed in sub 1146, the amount of the annual amortization for those costs, and the amount of the return on the unamortized balance of those costs, and if necessary and to the extent applicable, the amount of any other component of the costs included in the term in the determination of that total requested revenue requirement. All right, additionally, our staff would like to know what the total annual revenue requirement requested by the company in this proceeding is related to the recovery of the deferred CCR costs incurred from January 1st, 2018 through January 31st, 2020. Please provide the same information showing the calculation of this total annual revenue requirement as I've previously requested for the sub 1146 revenue requirement. And sort of as an additional piece of information, please provide the total North Carolina retail amount of deferred CCR costs incurred from January 1st, 2018 through January 31st, 2020, as most recently updated. All right, with that, unless there are any matters for my attention, we will proceed with Commissioner Brown Bland. All right, Commissioner Brown Bland, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Mitchell. Good morning, Ms. Williams. I was just about to ask you a question when we stopped yesterday.
Good morning, Commissioner.
And I apologize that I guess you're up and ready over there at 6:30. My first question was, in your testimony, on page 54, after you spoke about regulatory uncertainty as a basis for waiting before taking action with regard to the company CCRs, you had a statement there in my copy. It's down near the bottom of that page, but it says, closing or upgrading an ash basin before issuance of the final requirements could easily lead to actions that would, a relatively short time later when the rules were finalized, be either insufficiently rigorous or overly stringent. In either case, this could lead to expenditures that would be imprudent absent a situation where environmental damage would occur or be exacerbated if the ash pond was not upgraded or closed prior to the deadlines in the final CAMA CCR rule. There is, are you taking the position that DEC acted prudently if it made no change in the manner in which it disposed of its CCRs unless such a change was required by statute, regulation, or an agency directive from a regulatory agency having jurisdiction?
No, that it wasn't my position. My position was that if there was an environmental issue that was understood at the time, that the company, to be prudently behaving, would need to take some kind of action But in the absence of either a regulatory requirement or an environmental issue that was understood, then I believe it was prudent to wait because the uncertainty that was put into play by the 2010 EPA proposed rule was quite extreme. And the three choices that were discussed in that rule in terms of where EPA might finalize the requirements were order, at least well over an order of magnitude of cost differences. And EPA was clearly still trying to evaluate all the comments that it was receiving from all the parties and complete its risk work to decide what at least the agency felt was necessary to be protective of health and the environment as a generalized standard. So in answer directly to your question, I believe that if there was an environmental issue that was they were aware of, for example, an exposure to somebody's drinking water well, they needed to move to address that. But I think as Mr. Wells was explaining, they had been doing that throughout the period of time after the proposed rule. So given that they addressed environmental issues that were known in terms of risks, I think it was very prudent for them to wait for this rule to finalize.
So you are saying then that if there was a situation where environmental damage would occur or be exacerbated by waiting, then earlier spending or taking action could have been prudent.
Well, I think the starting point would have been to have continued to try and identify if such a situation existed, which in my review of the company's activities in that time frame, they were doing, and then to work with DEQ to figure out what kind of an action was appropriate. Given the complexity of doing, of selecting appropriate remedial measures, the appropriate action may have been additional groundwater monitoring at that time to get better information. So it's very case specific, site specific, but I do think it would have, I mean, it is my opinion that they would have needed to work with DEQ to figure out what the next steps of appropriate action were. As I say, in my review of the company's activities in that window of time between 2010 and when the final rule came out, it looked to me they were doing precisely that.
And I want to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Wells yesterday, based on your review and what you know about what the company was doing through having done your review, your homework, based on your knowledge and professional judgment, when or on what date did it become reasonably known that it would have been prudent for the company to dispose of CCRs by means other than unlined basins?
I don't think that you would reach that date until EPA effectively completed its work to finalize the rule, which was late 2014. I think it was known and prudent to have groundwater monitoring well systems in place at facilities in the 2010 timeframe. Many coal ash facilities across the country did not have groundwater monitoring in place in that timeframe. DEC did have it in at all its facilities in that time frame. So I think I would distinguish between when it was appropriate to make sure you had groundwater monitoring systems in and when it was clear that a separate or a different approach was appropriate for managing CCR. As I said in answer to your previous question, though, on a case-specific basis, if the company was working with DEQ on a particular issue with regard to a particular pond, and that led to a determination that for a given ash pond, something different should be done, then obviously it would have been prudent to proceed. But from what I can see, they were working with DEQ and they were taking actions to do the next proper step, which was, for the most part, improve the monitoring system to get a better understanding of what was really going on. So I didn't see any specific date prior to the finalization of the CCR rule that I could give you.
From a nation point of view, since you were at the EPA level, And even though you left the EPA in around 1988, but as you watched and followed these issues even after that start to occur to the industry and folks who work in the area like yourself, that there was the possibility, a reasonable possibility, that the waste in the unlined basins would have to be moved, that the unlined basins would not remain a permanent site?
I think if I'm speaking for EPA, and I think they discussed this in the preamble to either the final rule or one of the supplemental rules that have come out after 2015, EPA actually thought that most of these ponds would probably close in place. So it wasn't that, I think EPA did think a number of the existing ponds would close, but in place. I think EPA was actually somewhat surprised by the direction taken by many states to require as much excavation as they did. So I guess that's really the way I would answer that. I don't think that it was predictable that Duke would need to excavate all of its ash basins as a result of this rule.
Right, but I guess my question is, were people even looking to and thinking that this was a reasonable possibility in EPA's or anybody else's wheelhouse, that these that there would come directives, orders, regulatory situations where a pond would have to be excavated?
Well, I mean, I think there's always the possibility, but if you're asking me, was that something that was generally thought would be the direction that would people would go because it was a necessary for protection of risk-based protection, I think I would tell you no, not on a generalized basis. There might be an individual pond or an individual landfill where a determination was made that that was the appropriate thing to do. But it would have been very site specific, and it would have been as a result of analysis of the information available on a given pond. It was not a generalized belief that that was going to be necessary.
All right. Thank you for that. Mr. Wales, are you still with me?
Yes, ma'am.
I did have one question. So, part of what we've heard about maybe taking action too early, as referenced there in Ms. Williams' testimony, was a concern that somehow the regulatory body would frown upon or not approve cost recovery because it might be looked at as gallplating. Do you recall that argument as being made?
I'm honestly, I have not had that argument, and I'm not familiar with that. I'm not on the rates side of it in terms of that recovery, so I'm not familiar with that argument.
Would you have thought that would be a possible risk, that somehow if it were not a requirement in the law, that the commission might not allow recovery?
Well, I view it from the reasonableness of the utility's action, the company's actions, and that's what I was reviewing it from. And from that, in that context, I look at the regulatory requirements as well as where there is a potential threat to public health, whether that would drive some actions, and then all of that would have to be worked through the appropriate cost recovery mechanism. My point throughout is that that's not what we see if we look at the history of the basin in terms of construction and operation from the early days to today. There was a lot of actions taken to evaluate that risk, and it was not seen. They weren't realizing anything of that nature. So I was viewing the steps taken to the point where we are today have been reasonable.
Do you have any reason to think that with even without a requirement or directive or order, regulation or statute, that if, let's just pick a date and say 2001, if the company had come to the commission saying we're digging up these ponds because we now think this is the thing to do, and they make the case for it, you have some reason to think that it would be the absence of a law that would possibly cause the commission to deny coverage or recovery?
I think that's outside of my area.
All right. Do you think it would have been reasonable if the company's coming and making a case to the commission for this is the reason we want to do it, this is the exposure, this is a safety issue, do you think it would be reasonable that the company would be allowed to recover its costs?
When in my review, I didn't see where there was anything that rose to the level that would suggest there was a threat or risk to the public health. There was ongoing monitoring, ongoing verification of that. And if there was something like that, then I would expect the company to evaluate all options. So for instance, if there were, say, a potential impact where we believe that we have.
We're just talking hypothetical, so.
Okay, so okay. If there were a groundwater impact that we thought modeled to potentially in the future affect, say, a receptor well, that would be something the company would need and reasonably need to take action to evaluate. But when in doing that, it would be to evaluate all those options and to ensure that it's balancing the risk it's seeing with the cost and understanding the extent of the options. So in that instance, it may be a water line, or it could be a interceptor well, or some means of intercepting what believe may be a potential impact. The company didn't see any of that and still doesn't see that to this point. But hypothetically, it wouldn't be a wholesale, you know, I think if you looked at it and said, we have this, therefore we need to look at the things that would be necessary for, you know, an extreme solution, like excavate the basin in light of this potential risk. All those would be the measure.
Right. So if I'm understanding you correct, you're saying it would be an analysis and a balancing. And then whatever you decided on is a proper, reasonable thing to do, you would proceed from there and bring the case to the regulator. Is that fair to say?
If there were a risk of that nature presenting itself, the company would evaluate options and take the appropriate action. And if that's what the company has done.
Thank you. And then I'd just like to get an opinion or basically just fill out and get some information from the two of you. Do either of you know of any instance since the CCR rule or CAMA where a regulated utility was required by a regulatory agency to remove CCR from a basin that included a synthetic liner and then move the CCR somewhere because that liner was not acceptable under a CCR or CAMA type of statute? You familiar with any such thing?
Did you state, I may ask, I'll rephrase, I think I heard you say, do you mind?
If you are aware of any instance anywhere, doesn't have to be just here in North Carolina, but where after the adoption of the CCR rule or a CAMA type of statute, an electric utility was required to by a state regulatory agency to remove the CCRs from a basin that had a synthetic liner and move that because the synthetic liner was somehow unacceptable under a CCR rule or a CAMA type rule.
I'll let Marcia answer on a broader level. My familiarity is with North Carolina and there, my experience is with the 84 basin at Sutton, which was designed to be a liner, which was acceptable at the time. It was a clay line facility, and that basin was ordered for excavation. And I do know liners have progressed over time and over the last few decades, but that was one line facility that was ordered excavated.
But that was prior to the CCR or CAMA type rule.
The you mean when the basin was just required to be excavated?
Yes.
It was required to be excavated in 2014 with the passage of CAMA.
With the passage of CAMA, and it was a synthetic liner.
It was a clay liner.
All right. And Ms. Williams?
I don't think I can answer your question directly with regard to a CCR pond. What I thought I might share with you is that only 30% of ponds had the kind of composite liner by 2020 that EPA had talked about as a requirement of the CCR rule. And secondly, what I also can tell you is I am aware of quite a large number of hazardous waste facilities, whether it be a pond or a landfill, that did have synthetic liners where those liners did leak, because unfortunately liners are better than no liners, but they do in fact often leak both at the time of installation and later. So I certainly can give you examples where those kinds of issues have come up for hazardous waste facilities, but I can't tell you about CCR ponds being required to excavate. And normally in that case, if that happens, if you have a liner leak, okay, then you would have to remove waste and repair the liner. But what I would say with regard to excavation is if that pond had been placed in an area that, even if it was lined, that didn't meet EPA's location standards, then it's certainly very possible that it would have had to have been excavated if the state felt that failure to meet those location standards was not fully protective. So I think you're dealing both with the issue of liners and with the issue of a long list of location-related factors.
But you're not aware of an actual case where that's happened, though, at this point?
I can't cite you a specific case because I haven't followed the individual site-specific decisions. I think it's possible that we could, look at that, but I can't give you a case today.
What about, Madam Court Reporter, did you hear the end of that answer? She trailed off. I know what she said, but did you
catch? Yes, I'll be good.
All right, good. Do you know of any instance since the adoption of the CCR rule or the CAMA where a regulated electric utility was required by a state agency to remove an existing cap on a CCR base and then replace it with some other type of cap because that existing cap was not acceptable under the CCR rule or the CAMA type statute?
I think it may be too early to really give an answer to that because a lot of this is still evolving in the states at different locations. The final CCR rule has really been in litigation since the rule was finalized. EPA has issued a number of amendments to those to the rule. For the most part, the amendments are going more stringent, not less stringent. There have been a few places where EPA has allowed some site-specific variances to go in, but they're very limited. So I can't give you an example, but I don't think we're at the end of this yet. I think it's still evolving all over the country in terms of how this is being applied.
All right, and the only thing I might add on that, I think with respect to the North Carolina sites where we do have some of the historical basins that were capped in the sense of what may have been deemed capped in the day, typically inactivated in the sense that they no longer received ash. Those in instances where they may have had soil cover applied in the form of, what may have been viewed as a cap at the time and revegetated, that would be, currently those will all have to be removed and excavated.
All right, and do you know of an instance since the adoption of CCR and CAMA where the regulated utility was required by law or state agency to cease using the dry ash handling system and replace it with some other type of system because the dry ash system wasn't acceptable under the new CCR or CAMA type statute?
Again, I would just say that it wouldn't necessarily be the issue of whether the dry ash handling system was installed at the plant, but it would be the question of how the ash from the dry ash handling system was managed. And if that ash was put into a location, either in a landfill whose liner wasn't appropriate or in a landfill whose location standards were inappropriate, it would not be surprising to have that unit have to be remediated in some fashion.
All right, but today, is it fair to say that your answer means you're not aware of a situation where either the CCR rule itself or the CAMA type rule anywhere else in the nation has required these type actions that I'm asking about, the switch from an existing dry ash system or a switch or change from a cap in place?
I can give you examples where the rule would require that. I haven't done a national survey of all the different ash ponds to be able to answer your question. So I can't answer it one way or the other because I haven't done that kind of review. I can talk to you about that. There are situations in the rule that would be required. But they're hypothetical. If a company had done A, B, and C, then under the rule, they would not be able to leave it there and be in compliance with the rule. I haven't done a national survey.
This is Bo Summers. I apologize, yeah. Mr. Brown Bland. I wanted to point out, Ms. Williams, I believe we've lost your video. Would you check that, please?
She's back.
Pardon the interruption. Thank you.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Summers. Sitting here today, and subject to whatever call it homework, whatever other study or knowledge that you have, just sitting here today, you're not aware of such.
I'm not aware of such, but I don't think you can take that to assume that it's not happening. It just means I haven't done a thorough look at the 600 ash basins, 700 ash basins to understand what's happening to each of them in all the different states.
As a result of the CCR rule or, you know, as a result of recent legislation.
Correct. Recent regulations or state legislation.
And Mr. Wells, you have anything you want to add to that or you are in agreement?
I have nothing to add on that. No, I also have not looked nationally.
Let me see. One more thing. All right, I think that's all the questions I have. Thank you.
All right, I'll check in with Commissioner Gray again to see if he has questions.
No questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Klotfelter.
Yes, just a couple of things. Mr. Wells, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I really have just a few loose ends for you. In the company's 2003 10-year coal combustion products plan, there are a number of action items, and you don't need to have the document in front of you. It's just several of the plants, the action items in the plan included performing evaluations of conversion to dry ash handling. Two stick out in my memory. There was a recommendation to do that kind of evaluation for Dan River and for WS Lee plant. My question, that they have names of who was supposed to do the study and target dates for when they were supposed to be completed. My question to you is, do you know whether Those studies can be found in the record in this case or in the data requests that were served on the company. Do you know if those studies have been produced and made available?
I don't know if they have, Commissioner. The witness, Ben Narsik, had some information on that. I'm understanding she had talked with some of those folks, but on that specific issue, I don't know that what's in the record on that.
Do you know whether the studies were even done?
I don't know the details on that. I'm aware that the ultimate decisions were made and what the documentation was related to those. I'm not aware.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you. I'll pursue that in my laundry list of late filed exhibits that we're working on compiling. So I won't bother you with that anymore. But I am curious about one thing. Do you know? And I know this is maybe outside your area, but you might know it, so I'll ask it. Do you know when the company began to seriously explore converting units from coal to gas, or for example, Cliffside, Dan River? When did the consideration of converting Dan River to gas, for example, when did that start?
I apologize. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
Details.
All right. Again, as I say, there are just a few loose ends here. The other one is, are you familiar with the company's 2007 environmental management program for coal combustion products?
I'm familiar with that document, yes.
Okay. Was there any earlier iteration of that program plan, whether it had a different name? It might have had a different name, might have been called something else, but anything earlier iteration or similar to that that you know?
I've not seen anything of that ilk or things of that nature.
All right. Well, I know you don't have it in front of you. And I want to ask you a question really about the earlier period than that document. But in order to do that, I got to read you something from the document. So bear with me. I'm going to try to read it out. In the 2007 environmental management program, the statement of principle or philosophy of the company, I'm going to read to you. It says, Duke is committed to CCP management and disposal strategies which comply with all applicable state and federal regulations, are protective of human health and the environment, and reduce future risk associated with groundwater contamination. This compliance includes not only the specific requirements contained in the applicable regulations, environmental statutes, and environmental permits, but also the general regulatory requirement to ensure that ash reuse and disposal activities do not contribute to future exceedances of surface water or groundwater standards. And my question to you is, do you know whether that statement of philosophy or principle represented any change from what the company's prior policy and practices had been?
I don't think that's a change. I think it was documenting and restating the philosophy of what the company's policy was on those issues.
And that had been the policy before it was formalized in a written document.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wells. That's all I have. Thank you. Madam Chair, that's all I have.
All right, Commissioner Duffley.
Yes, I just have a few questions. Also clean up. So the first is for Mr. Wells. You were talking about regional offices. I assume a lot of the sites are in the Mooresville regional office, but what is the other, are there other regional offices involved and what are they?
Oh, I am not as well versed in the different regions. I typically think of the Raleigh regional office and the Mooresville office, and then Raleigh being the headquarters for DEQ. But as I think about it, based on your question, I believe the Raleigh Regional Office probably covered more of the Progress Energy sites versus the DEC sites. I do believe there are a couple other regional offices that would have been involved, but I can't remember, honestly, the structure of DEQ, the other regionals, or the other regions.
Okay, that's fine.
Asheville, I'm just remembered. Mooresville office, Asheville Regional would be another one I think that would be applicable to DEC.
Okay, thank you. And at one point in your testimony, you were describing the monitoring system that was being put in after 2015, I believe. And you were talking about how the groundwater monitoring system was very comprehensive. How would you describe the assessment with the wells that were installed in the 2009-2010 timeframe?
I think that was all part of that evolution of watching the groundwater. So I would describe it as the 2004 to 2008 timeframe, USWAG voluntary wells go in. And that is somewhat of a detection concept. And as you get into the 2009-10 timeframe, that data is being shared and reviewed with DEQ. And that's where DEQ is working with the Attorney General's office on some specific interpretations of the 2L rule. And there's some back and forth going on with respect to interpretations. But in parallel, DEC is adding additional wells at that time and working with the state on where they go. And that added a whole nother set of wells and moved a lot of the monitoring to the compliance boundary. Prior to that, the monitoring was inside the compliance boundary. And that was a big move to evaluate the status of the plume and whether or not it was moving beyond the compliance boundary. So that was a big, you know, a next sort of iterative and comprehensive step to understand the status of the area of impact. And then that moved even further, you know, as you saw the 9-10 data and 11 data develop additional work with DEQ to establish further assessment. And all of that was memorialized. That process is what was memorialized in the DEQ policy memorandum of 2011 that I was referring to.
Okay, thank you. And then I think the last question for you is, you also testified maybe once or twice that you stated, if we see a risk to public health, we take action. So what specific actions in the past can you name to support that statement?
Well, with respect to DEC, Duke Energy Carolina, Belews Creek is, I think, a very good example, early 80s. Where there was monitoring of the fishery going on to detect what, if any, impacts we would be having, similar to surface water monitoring that was going on elsewhere. And when that was detected, then the company moved to evaluate how it could minimize that risk. And it looked at wastewater treatment concepts. They investigated, determined it was a selenium issue, looked at wastewater treatment, looked at moving the outfall, and ended up moving toward dry fly on that project. And that based in part on the environmental, but also the economics based on the market of the ability of the other factors that came into play. But that was an instance where the company detected an issue and moved based on a risk to the surface water, to the ecosystem. And if they had also seen an issue elsewhere like that, then that would have been an appropriate type step. The other issue is evaluating the risk to receptors, meaning an offsite well or a well that someone may be drinking, a private well. And there the company, if you look as early as the 80s, you see an analysis of the groundwater direction of what's going on and an understanding of groundwater flow in these areas and how it's flowing. There was never an indication of that risk was being realized, that there was a risk to the public health. Now, when we moved into the 2014 monitoring, additional steps pursuant to the 2011 policy, we did additional evaluations at that time for further verification with respect to offsite wells. and then did follow-up sampling even at all of those wells. And those wells, I mean, the result was there was no evidence of impact from site operations, so no action needed to be taken. But that's an example of the type of analysis that would have been done. If there was an issue, we would have taken action to address it. There are examples elsewhere outside of DEC where we did see that. For instance, I'm familiar with actions we've taken in the Midwest. I'm familiar with actions we've taken in Ohio and Indiana where some of those risks were realized. I'm familiar with where steps were taken in Progress Energy, where we put in water lines proactively, voluntarily, in order to address what we viewed as a potential issue before there was an impact. But those are some examples of what, if there was a risk that warranted it, the company would have taken action. And I saw that in Progress Energy sites. I saw it in the Midwest sites. And with respect to DEC, we didn't have indications that those were outside. Blues Creek is an example of where we saw it, but we weren't seeing that from the monitoring that was ongoing, the additional wells that were going in the 90s, the additional wells that went in 2000s, the additional monitoring that went in 2010, the additional monitoring that's going on in 2014. Again, it's not presenting that risk to the public health in terms of surface water impacts, ecosystem, or the public wells. So that the action's not there. The analysis to verify it's not there has been done.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wells. And then Mrs. Williams, you testified. Good morning.
Good morning.
I know it's early for you. So you testified twice yesterday that Duke was ahead of the industry with regard to groundwater monitoring. And can you provide specific facts or that support that statement?
Well, again, the facts that I rely on for that are a lot of the national surveys that EPA did over time that talked about how many locations had groundwater monitoring. So I tried to go through some of them yesterday. I have a number of them in my testimony. But for example, in the 1988 report to Congress on coal ash, EPA talked about it. But more importantly, EPA did a very broad and complete study of how many sites had groundwater monitoring in 1986 for all types of surface impoundments. And included in that were coal ash ponds, but it was much broader than just coal ash ponds. So I used those statistics, okay? And those statistics, again, consistently from the 80s all the way through to the timeframe when EPA was doing its proposed rule, you were seeing numbers like 32%, 33%, 35% of these facilities had groundwater monitoring installed. And so I think it really is noteworthy that by the time you get to 2008, you know, when Duke had completed installing initial well systems at all of its facilities that hadn't already installed them due to a requirement in an NPDES permit, they installed it at the rest of the facilities by 2008. And so they had already started to generate this groundwater data at all these sites, and it is iterative, as we've talked about. So, of course, after the first system went in, additional wells would be added to begin to answer more questions. As Mr. Wells said, the groundwater system wells were moved out further to the compliance boundary. Additional compounds were added to the analysis. You had a better sense of groundwater flow once you put a system in, so you may find out that you need additional upgradient wells or additional downgradient wells. So that's what was happening then post-2008, and that was not happening, as I say, at a very large number of coal ash facilities, both landfills and ponds, but sticking with ponds. You know, it wasn't happening at 70% of the ponds. Now, it was happening more at newly constructed ash ponds. There weren't a lot of newly constructed ash ponds, but it was happening more. But even with the newly constructed ash ponds, I believe that something like 80% of them may have put monitoring in and 20% hadn't put monitoring in. So the statistics that I'm sharing with you are coming either out of EPA's coal ash documents, the proposed rule, the final rule, some information that EPA has published in additional proposed rules post-2015, or they're coming from studies that EPA did back in 1977, studies EPA did in, published in 1983, 1986, 1991, all of which looked at ponds, industrial ponds across the country, and all of which found that there were very reasonably limited groundwater monitoring at those facilities.
And you just, there's a lot of documents filed in this case. You mentioned though, in your testimony that, and I guess this was probably, I just want to confirm that it was around the 2009 timeframe. You mentioned that Duke had groundwater monitoring at all of its ash basins compared to industry, which only had groundwater monitoring in 42% of its basins. Can you direct me to where you obtained that statistic?
Yes, that would be from EPA's June 2010 proposed rulemaking for the for this final CCR rule, but this was the proposed rule.
Okay, thank you. Those are all of my questions, Chair Mitchell. Thank you.
All right, Commissioner Hughes.
Yes, I have a few questions about closure in place. And feel free, either one in the panel, you know, I'm assuming Ms. Williams, you'd give me the national perspective, but also to the extent that you're aware of what Duke was going through, please, Mr. Wells, chime in. I know Duke didn't close a lot of ash ponds prior to when a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about started to transpire, but I think there were a few, if I'm not mistaken, Allen maybe in 1973, and then maybe one or two in the 80s. Could you tell me what was happening with the closure in place regime, going back as long as you can, but at least for sure starting in 80s, 90s, 2000s? What was happening with closure in place? You had said, I think, Ms. Williams, there's an order of magnitude between closure in place and excavate. Was closure in place getting any more stringent? Was a closure in place in 1980 looking anything different than 1973, 1990, 2000? Did they look different?
Well, I think from a let me give a national response, and Ms. Boyles can tailor it. But the typical closure for ash ponds in the 70s, 80s wasn't really changing. First of all, you have to realize that even if an ash pond was no longer accepting, let's say, new or additional fly ash, it often was continuing to accept stormwater or other waste streams from the site. But once it was no longer receiving waste streams, typically it would be dewatered either naturally or aggressively. And it would be revegetated. And that was generally what was going on. And I think there is a picture of sort of that in the 1988 EPA report to Congress that sort of showed that was really the national practice for closure at that time. And I think even if you look at the one of those early EPRI manuals, it talks about revegetation, you know, after a pond is no longer in operation. So it wasn't the kind of capping that started to be discussed in the post-2000 timeframe. And so I think nationally, the primary closure at that point was dewatering and putting a different kind of cap, you know, not just soil vegetation, but a different kind of cap. But that was largely in the timeframe when you're talking post-2010, when people are starting to think about what kind of a protective regime could exist for closure of these ponds. And in my response to Commissioner Brown Bland, I tried to suggest, you know, I think EPA clearly allowed for the concept of excavation as a site-specific closure requirement, but the general thought is that these ponds would, for the most part, dewater, close in place with a cap system that was more of a clay-based and possibly a synthetic clay-based cap system. Excavation was available, but not what EPA believed was likely to be done at a high percentage of the ponds. And I guess the cost figure I had given out previously when I said at least an order of magnitude difference was really a choice about whether EPA had chosen to regulate these ponds under its hazardous waste framework versus its solid waste framework. So that's, it wasn't strictly just closure, it was the entire set of regulations that would apply if you were doing it under its hazardous waste framework, which would have been extremely much more expensive because not only the closure requirements would have been different, but the permitting requirements would have been different. And there would have been a requirement to treat all ash in a different way before it could be even put into a land disposal unit to start with. So the requirements that EPA was considering, both for the closure design and for the ongoing management of ash in either a landfill or a pond, would have been dramatically different if EPA had chosen a hazardous waste framework for these CCR units than where they ultimately came out, which was a solid waste framework. And in fact, the other big difference between EPA's choices in 2010 was under one of the frameworks, EPA would have allowed federally these ponds to continue to operate for the remainder of their useful life. Whereas in the selection, in the framework that they did select, they had a more limited operation allowance under certain conditions for existing ponds. So that's why there was so much uncertainty between what was going on in 2010 and what was known after EPA finalized its CCR rule. The uncertainty was dramatic because EPA hadn't yet signaled where it was going. And I think while that's a national rule and North Carolina had its options under state rules to do what it wanted, I think North Carolina, like many states, really was interested in understanding where EPA was going to come out, because North Carolina clearly didn't want to come out in a position that it would be inconsistent with where the federal rules would come out.
I appreciate that. Just a couple follow-ups, but really I'm just really focused on the closure in place. So all of the, you know, all of the other parts of what we've already, I think, talked a lot about that. The 2004 or 5 EPRI closure manual has a comment that closure of surface impoundments will probably be the most expensive task undertaken during a commission process. Would that be true even if there had been closure in place to the standards that you're talking about in 2004? Was it still going to be, and this might be a question for Mr. Wells, was it still a very expensive, maybe the most significant, most expensive part of decommissioning of the dewatering and the capping as of, say, 2003, 4, 5?
I mean, first of all, I think the type of decommissioning that's being discussed in the 2004 EPRI manual is sites that are decommissioning. In other words, it's not just it's not ash pond closure solely. It's decommissioning of a utility station. So that's what it was looking at. And that document makes the very strong point that how expensive it is in part depends on how you want to reuse this property. So one of the examples that they gave in that manual involved reusing the property, you know, trying to essentially reuse the property for something entirely different than what it was currently being used for. So that drives to a large extent what the cost will be of closure and decommissioning of the whole facility. I think there's another EPRI manual that came out, I think in around 2001, that actually did discuss specifically closure of ash basins, and talked about the fact that the closure of ash basins, it wasn't clear that any kind of capping beyond just vegetation was really going to, and dewatering was actually going to accomplish any additional protection. So I think this concept of a capping, the way we're talking about in the final CCR rule, a closure in place with a more significant cap, really wasn't what was being thought about in the 2000 to 2006 timeframe.
So Mr. Wells, just a quick question. So what was likely to be being thought about by your colleagues back then, this less extensive capping, was that still going to be one of the most expensive tasks undertaken during a decommissioning process?
Well, I think
similar. And I know we're rushing for time, so maybe a quicker answer.
You got it. I think it very much was unknown. I think it was highly speculative as to what the appropriate closure requirements were going to be at that time. And
if it was a cap in place, what was the weak, on the left side of the spectrum of the cost? So you don't have.
I think
lots of people are asking you to imagine the future. I don't want you to imagine the future. Just imagine the so-called, I guess, best case scenario from a cost standpoint. What did that look like?
Okay, and I can tell you what the practice was at that point with respect to Duke, at least what I've seen. And I think you mentioned a couple of the ponds, what were they doing? Were they closed? So the practice at that point was Ms. Williams described almost nationally, the basins that had been deactivated or inactivated, they were closed in place, in essence, just no longer sluicing, allowed dewatering, soil cap, and reestablished vegetation. That's what I've seen in the various ponds that went inactive over the period. And that's with respect to both what I saw with Progress, it's all Carolinas, and what I also saw up in some of the ponds in the Midwest. So that seemed to be sort of where things were. Now I think what you're asking, that to me, there's one question, I think certainly in that time period, is that enough? And then if that's the case, then what is the additional cost? And it would be very minimal. On the other hand, and I do think this is the time when there's a lot of discussion, this is representative of the ongoing sort of evolution of discussion of what is the pond future. And there is some planning going on with respect to that. And I believe what you're seeing in that type of comment is where the ponds end up in terms of cost is it can vary significantly based on what it ends up being, this future closure, what's adequate under the regs, the needs of the facility for reuse, or how that might be viewed. It could be significant. But again, on the left side of the spectrum, it could also be relatively consistent with what was being done at that time, perhaps with some additional review or verification that whatever is installed meets what a cap standard that may be established, or that additional cap could be added. I mean, there is a lot at that point, a lot of uncertainty or variability in what that would look like. That's my sense of it. And I think
if I asked you in 2002 of the decommissioning of some of your facilities, was closure going to be significant or insignificant? If you only had to choose those two words, would you say, or you can say relatively if you want, relatively insignificant, relatively significant? I'm just trying to get an idea of where it was in the world of planning.
I think that's would be very difficult for me to estimate. I don't think they saw it as significant if it did not involved the need for it depended on the reuse of the property and the need to have that closure be a piece meet the needs future reuse of the property. If it was just a basin that was sitting retired at the time, additional actions potentially necessary for closure, my view at that time would have been, I believe that it wasn't. It could be significant if driven to some of the higher end discussion of what may be required, but if it was consistent with status quo or something close, then that would be more, that would be insignificant. Not insignificant, but less significant.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
All right, Commissioner Hughes. I mean, I'm sorry, Commissioner McKissick.
Just one or two questions. I appreciate the testimony these witnesses have provided over the last day or so, and it's certainly been exhaustive, and they've covered things very thoroughly. So I think I pretty well understand the scope of their testimony and the issues in terms of their perspective, the way they believe things occurred during this entire time frame. A couple of quick questions, though, and I guess the first one would be of Ms. Williams. I know you were at the EPA, and you were there from 1970 up to February of 88. Is that correct, ma'am?
Yes, I actually started at what's now EPA a little bit before EPA was formed, and then it got folded into EPA. And I left at the end of February, actually like the last day of February of 88.
Okay, and you were director of the Office of Solid Waste from, I guess, September of 85 up through February 88. So I guess that was your title during that entire window of time?
During the window of September of 85 through the end of February 88, yes.
And from what I gather, there were like 250 people that fell under that unit. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And of course, we had lots of other support from our research office and other places, but those are the people that were directly in the Office of Solid Waste.
Now, the report to Congress that was entitled Waste from the Combustion of Coal by the Electric Utility Power Plants, what date was that actually released? Do you recall?
I believe it was released in February of 1988.
So it was right as you were leaving, is that correct?
I was there through February, but and the work for the report was clearly done for time before that in order to be able to release it on that date. But I was there, as I recall, for the release date.
Did you actually participate in work that was in that report? I mean, who was actually delegated responsibility for, I guess, doing the research and whatever was required that went into the drafting of the report? Were you involved with that? And if you were, to what extent?
Well, I was responsible for everything that left my office. I mean, I managed that office. And while I wasn't doing drafting, I was doing reviews of the document. Asking questions of, at the time, things I felt weren't thoroughly vetted or discussed, and trying to make sure that we were producing the best report we could to Congress. I mean, I was in my position, I was meeting with congressional staff on a pretty regular basis because during this whole period of time, from really when I took over that position to when I left, we had been implementing a whole set of requirements that Congress had put on the agency in late 1984. And so I was constantly at the Hill trying to answer all the questions about when is this going to be done and where are you on this and how are you doing on this and where are all the facilities in their performance. So the answer is I was involved. I did not draft the report, but I did review the report more than once.
Were there members of staff that did not concur with the recommendation set forth in the report?
As I'm sitting here today, I do not have a recollection of that. I'm not saying there weren't, because there were always staff that potentially could raise concerns, and I certainly can think of one or two issues that came out of my office where staff did raise concerns, but I don't have a recollection of any disagreement on the results of this report from the people that were working.
Were there any recommendations in findings that came forth from staff that you revised or you know, in any respect before the final report was released?
I just don't have a recollection of that today, Commissioner. I mean, it's possible, I suppose, because those things would happen and they were vetted carefully, you know, when people had different opinions, but I don't have a recollection of that as I'm sitting here right now.
Okay. Thank you. And of course, Mr. Wells, one or two quick questions of you. I know there was a report that was dated September 27, 2012, that Duke Energy prepared dealing with guidance on developing closure plans for ash basins. Are you familiar with that?
I'm somewhat familiar with that.
You're somewhat familiar with it.
I don't remember specifics.
Because among the things that it talked about was closure plans, potential regulatory issue requirements, planning consideration, development of closure plans, environmental characterizations, and selection of closure options, and even went as far as dealing with some cost. Do you remember any of that?
It sounds familiar. I believe I have seen that. I just don't remember the specifics.
Okay. Well, if you don't remember specifics, it would be difficult to ask you questions about it. Perhaps what I'm going to go back and review a number of the exhibits which have been referred to during the course of this hearing, and there may be a request for a late file exhibit to get some additional explanations and clarity. The thing that I'm concerned about, or interested in knowing, I should say, is if this report was prepared in 2012, granted it was late in the game, but what actions were taken as a direct result of the recommendations that it suggested and the scope of issues that it covered that could have perhaps resulted in actions being taken before we had CCR approved and before count?
I could speak generally. I'm familiar with the
time. Okay, well, go ahead. Speak generally, if you could.
Okay. So in that time frame, there was no guidance on closure at either the federal or the state level. Yet the company is pushing toward that and pushing toward closure. There is, starting to try to move that in terms of what are the specifications, what's the criteria with respect to closure. What are the options? What needs to be proven? All those type of things. What will be the design? So those details are important for purposes of planning and execution. And those were in state flux at that time, meaning there was no state standard. There was no federal standard. It was a recognition that the federal standards was a draft rule and an anticipation that a final is coming, but it has options that cover a very broad spectrum. That's what's in the draft rule, but not yet finalized. On the other hand, on the state level, this document and the interaction that was going on with the state was to drive some state standards with respect to closure, while recognizing also that the federal rule was out there too. So they will have to marry up at some time. And the company's moving this in that direction while also recognizing there's this uncertainty. But it is also working with the state on important criteria with respect to closure, which is protection of the environment and stability, all the things that are important. So that's all being developed sort of in parallel, recognizing that we will move toward a point where we'll have that clarity and then be able to execute on closure.
And that draft CCR rule, when was that first released? Refresh my recollection.
That the draft rule, I believe, was 2010.
That's what I thought.
Ms. Williams, could you confirm?
Yes, it was mid-year 2010 when the proposed rule came out.
And perhaps, Mr. Wells, you can tell me, what was Duke's response to the proposed rule going back to 2010? I mean, what actions did they take when that rule was first published to make comment publicly or likewise what it might have done that was not public.
So first, would have certainly reviewed the rule, all of that. I mean, normal course is to understand what might be the movements in the regulatory front for purposes of assisting with planning and ensuring we're making the right decisions moving forward. With respect to that rule, it was anticipated, I think, around that time that there were some continued developments that EPA would be coming out with. And so it would have been an important rule. We would have reviewed it. And I believe the company may have submitted comments, but I don't know. But there would have been interaction also with our utility peers, how they were viewing it, you know, some benchmark potentially. I think those are the type of actions that are typical for us to do to understand what we think is that the rule is headed, and where we think it's headed, and what the timing might be.
And what were the most significant differences between the proposed rule and the final adopted rule?
I'll speak generally, and then Ms. Williams may be able to help. She's very, very familiar with EPA regs, of course, and process. The proposed rule, my recollection, and it is in Ms. Williams' testimony, there it had several options, but one was a hazardous waste subtitle C that you hear referred to, and a subtitle D, and then a subtitle D prime. So in part, what the federal government was doing is saying, we are looking at and we want comment on these type options. The implication from my perspective of those three options is very, very extreme. I mean, meaning if it goes subtitle C, that is a very big deal. I mean, it's all good regulatory important the way it was developed and founded, but the subtitle C would be the highest level of control in a hazardous waste level of regime. So that's very, I think, very stringent, very costly, a whole lot of unknowns of what that would really mean on the scale. There was a lot of discussion about what that would mean, because that's a very big, hard to even understand how you'd implement that level of detail in something of this ash ponds, the scale that we were working. The other one, subtitle D, which was more like a solid waste, what you would see for a municipal solid waste that developed over time, similar to this in the sense of how that's managed, a traditional solid waste facility. And then subtitle D prime, which I'll let Ms. Williams build on a little bit, but that was, I believe, just allowing continued operations of basins under certain conditions. In other words, as is, continued ops would be acceptable under the reg, but perhaps some additional regulations to manage that. Those were the three, in my mind, the big differences. And then the final rule is where some of that was resolved, but then it also added some additional requirements that were in there and performance criteria and other things that we ultimately are implementing. And Ms. Williams, I'd welcome if you could add any detail to that that's relevant.
Thanks, Mr. Rolls. Just a couple of things that I would add. I certainly agree with all the examples that Mr. Wells provided. I think one of the other significant differences, besides the fact there was just so much uncertainty in which regulatory scheme EPA would base the final rule on, is the dealing with addressing ponds that had not yet closed. In other words, perhaps they were taking stormwater, but they hadn't fully closed and there was still liquid in the ponds. So that EPA was completely silent on that under a subtitle D solid waste framework when they did the proposed rule, but they clarified and covered in the final rule that inactive ponds that still had liquid in them would be subject to the closure requirements under the final rule. So that was a pretty significant change, and one that I think people had not really been able to fully evaluate because they hadn't fully understood what EPA's position was at the time of the proposed rule. Another one is some of the location standards change. So I know Ms. Benarsik discussed the final location standards that said if a pond wasn't 5 feet separated from the aquifer, that it would have to close. Well, in the proposed rule, that was 2 feet. So it was a significant change, for example, in that provision. And there was also a change in which of the low volume waste streams were allowed to be managed in ponds between the proposed rule and the final rule. So those are just some other examples. There were quite a few changes, really. And certainly the most important changes, there was now certainty, or at least EPA thought there was certainty until there was all the litigation that occurred after the rule, and the changes are continuing.
Let me ask you this. I mean, considering the range that EPA was examining between the proposed rule up until the rule of final was adopted, and the way that, you know, the cold ash residuals and the impoundments could have been treated, do you think that there was more that Duke could have done to have mitigated the impact of the impoundments based upon the knowledge that was available at that time?
It's my opinion that Duke was actively investigating the groundwater at that time. And I alluded to this, but that is not a quick process. That is a long process. EPA's experience and North Carolina's experience on hazardous waste facilities is the time first to get a fully adequate system in, and then to use that system to evaluate what is an appropriate corrective action, which could include closure, it could include excavation, it could not include those things and just include some type of a groundwater pump and treat or a slurry wall or something else, okay? But the time frame to get that process done is really on average 20 years. It is not quick, okay? And it's not quick because you're trying to understand a subsurface environment that is not easy to understand. So I believe, in my review, what Duke was doing starting by 2008 when it had all the wells in, was all the initial wells in, was working with DEQ in an iterative fashion to improve that system to begin to answer the question of what was appropriate and protective and necessary. And I don't know what else would have been appropriate, because you have to do that work before you can come to a final determination as to what the right remedy is. So in my opinion, Duke was doing precisely the kind of work. They weren't just sitting there waiting for the rule to be final. They were working with DEQ to investigate the full range of the impacts and what would be the appropriate action based on that. And ultimately, even though the final rule that EPA put out provided flexibility in the closure method, North Carolina used all the data that it had and made a determination that it thought it was more appropriate to excavate. But they couldn't have gotten to the right decision if Duke hadn't been doing all the work that had started back in the 2008 time. And it really, it started before, but it started aggressively in the post 2008 timeframe. So that's my opinion.
Okay. And I understand what occurred 2007, 2008 in terms of actions that were taken. But let me ask you this hypothetically. Let's say that CCR hadn't been adopted to 2019. Would it have still been reasonable based upon information that was known just to continue waiting and waiting and waiting until EPA made a decision? I mean, is that what I'm essentially hearing? I mean,
I hope you're not hearing that from me, Commissioner.
Well, at some point you said 20 years was what you thought might be reasonable.
But no, I'm saying that
what you stated, because I don't want to, you know, maybe I misheard what you stated. Yeah.
I'm saying that from the time what EPA has determined, that even once you know that there is some contamination in groundwater, and I'm giving EPA's experience, but I've looked at the North Carolina hazardous waste sites that have been doing these same kinds of investigations. And to stay with North Carolina sites, hazardous waste sites, From the time that they were told, if there's by regulation, if there's groundwater contamination, you need to figure out what's appropriate to do at your site. And if you look at North Carolina's data, it took on average until 2020 for most of these facilities to get to a place that they could begin to implement the requirements. And that's because it isn't that they were doing nothing. It's that they were investigating with the state what action would address and solve the problem. And different actions are selected for different facilities. And I'm just applying that same thing and saying, I think once Duke was working with the state, which is whether you say 2008, 2010, developing, putting in more wells as needed, developing the models, understanding exactly what was going on in the subsurface, then whether EPA had finalized its rule or not, there would be a time where sufficient information was available to the state of North Carolina to make its decision with regard to what should happen at those ponds. But I don't think it would have been before the time the final rule finalized, just out of practical looking at the nature of iterative evaluation to get your system right and to get your groundwater modeling right, which is the way decisions are being made today. They're being made based on very sophisticated groundwater models that are site specific and that evaluate not only what the groundwater looks like today, but what the groundwater will look like if you take various corrective actions, including closure in place, closure by excavation, not closure, but other types of potential remedies. So Duke was in that process. And I think they would have reached the end of that process with North Carolina, even if EPA hadn't finalized its rule. But I don't think they would have been able to finalize it before the date of finalization of the rule.
Thank you for that clarity. Madam Chair, I don't have any further questions at this time. Thank you.
All right, Commissioner Brown Bland.
Yes, thank you. I just had one sort of follow-up to what Commissioner McKissick was just asking. So as opposed to closing an existing facility, is it your testimony that you find it was prudent up through the final rule for the company to continue to add CCR content to existing facilities, as opposed to at some point along the continuum of evolution that we've been discussing, start to put the current waste in a line facility?
Commissioner, are you asking that question to me or to both of us? Or
both.
Okay, well, maybe I'll start and let Mr. Wells finish. My opinion is, again, I think in some of these sites, they may not have been adding additional slurry coal ash in the window of time between 2010 and 2015. But I think what was important is they were very closely working with the state agency. And I think to the extent that they were, sorry. To the extent that they were finding that ceasing sluicing would have made a difference, I think the state would have requested that at that point. They were working extremely closely together. So I don't think that at that point one can second guess the discussions that were going on between the regulatory agency and DEC at that point in time. So I believe that what they were doing starting in 2010 was appropriate and prudent.
And even prior, you know, we're talking about the continuum, and I assume that, and maybe I'm wrong, you can go ahead and correct me if I am, that the continuum of discussion going back from 81 forward as it moved, even though that might be considered by some to be at a slow pace, but as it moved, the continuum was going in some direction, some fathomable direction that was given some clues away from the use of the way we were storing our pole ash or our CCRs. So over that continuum, though, you don't think that it was prudent to consider or to take steps to lessen what was going on in the existing basis, to lessen the materials that were being added?
I believe that if you look at the, and I don't want to repeat all the things that we've said, so I believe if you look at the steps that DEC took in the 1980s to evaluate whether there was a potential risk, that those studies reasonably demonstrated to the company in that time frame that its current practices would not have resulted in a reasonable risk of environmental problems. I think, as Mr. Wells stated and I looked at as well, where they did see something like at the Belews Creek facility in surface water, they did take action. And in my review of the documents, I also saw that they were proactively looking at receptors once you got into the time frame of the 2008 and later kind of time frame and checking out that information. So I believe in light of that, and in light of the fact that they had installed groundwater monitoring systems before many of the industry had done it at all their facilities and were then improving them and working with them, I believe they did what you would reasonably expect a prudent utility to do. And so I guess that's the answer, my answer to your question.
And the receptors, that's not the only measure or is it that you would be looking at? Because it's my understanding that the company put a lot of property around trying to create some type of buffer between them and the next property owner. So that would eliminate receptors. Wasn't it important to look, at more than just receptors?
Well, I'm using receptors broadly. It's not just humans. It's ecological and so on. And in the framework that I guess I've spent my 50-year career with, the goal is to protect human health and the environment. That's the goal of regulations. It's not to do more than that. It's to do that. And so it is my view that there are times where it is appropriate to buy additional property and allow monitored natural attenuation to occur because you will achieve environmental protection at less cost. And if you can achieve environmental protection with less cost, that's a good thing. So I that's my view on sort of that type of a corrective action.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wales, you got anything? You heard that part of our discussion. Anything you want to add to?
No, I thank you. I agree that, the company did, as you referenced the continuum, what I saw is the company operated consistent with that evolution of the science, the regulatory requirements, regulatory priorities, public policy, public commentary on these issues. Because you're right, there is a continuum, and if you look at the actions of the company, it is consistent with that continuum, or in some instances, exceeding, for instance, industry standards, where they're very proactively doing things. But and I base that on the documents that you see studies, you see analysis, you see conclusions. You see the monitoring ramping up, we starting with Allen, and you see Marshall and Belews in the late 80s and some Cliffside work and W.S. Lee, Dan River in the 90s. By the time you get into the mid 90s, late 90s, there's been groundwater monitoring at all facilities with the exception of Buck. And then in the mid 2000s, even more monitoring goes in on a voluntary basis. And then, of course, additional wells in 2010 and all those things. And the important things that are always being looked at were the things that I think you're looking at, or you mentioned, which was receptors in the sense of wells, but also the public or the water, the receiving waterways, and the monitoring that's ongoing with all of those and continuing with all of that data telling us there's no flag that is saying there's this risk presenting itself. It's verification that risk is not there or that it's not being realized. But then that's getting more and more rigorous with time along that continuum. And I found it consistent with what I viewed as all of the, the science, the regulatory priorities, the regulations themselves, as well as the public movement in this direction.
All right. And I just wanted to clarify, Mr. Wells, from our previous discussion, when I was asking about had existing caps had to be moved post CCR rule in CAMA. And you mentioned that, yes, CAMA had required the excavation of basins of pond, unlined basins of pond that were capped. But you were referring to a soil cap, right? Soil caps? You're not aware?
Correct.
Okay, and you're not aware of any that were synthetic cap that had to be removed, were you? As a result of CAMO and the CCR rule?
The only thing I think might be relevant there is the Allen. There is the retired ash basin at Allen.
Had a synthetic cap?
Well, it had the landfill built on top of, which had a cap. So that was a kind of a unique situation. It was being viewed as a cap. That was moving toward excavation, and originally we have other basins that look like that, and originally those were all required to be excavated in the original order, but the ultimate settlement didn't require that for all.
All right, thank you very much. That's all.
All right, Mr. Wells, I'd like to just follow up with you on one comment you made in response to one of the commissioners. You indicated that you didn't know if the company or Duke Energy had submitted comments on the proposed CCR rule. So I'd like for you to dig into y'all's records and see if you can determine whether the company did submit comments during the rulemaking process and provide those comments as a late filed exhibit, please.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. At this point, we will take questions on the commissioner's questions, beginning with intervening parties, public staff. You may proceed if you have any.
Thank you. This is Nadia Lohr. I just have a couple of questions for Mr. Wells. Good morning, Mr. Wells.
Good morning.
So Commissioner Brownbland yesterday asked you questions regarding the selection of the Allen plant for both Duke's internal evaluation and participation in the EPA and Arthur D. Little studies. Do you remember that question?
I do, yes.
And so the Allen site consists of the retired ash basin and the active ash basin, is that correct?
Today, yes. Okay. And the landfill.
Correct. And the retired ash basin stopped receiving sluiced ash and was filled and basically stopped operating in the 1972 to 1973 timeframe. Is that correct? And we can refer to documents if we need to, or we can go off your recollection.
If you let me take a quick look at something I can. I did not have the date in front of me of when the retired ash basin no longer received ash.
Okay. Do you have Janus Exhibit 4?
I can look. Yes, I have that.
Okay, so if you, I guess there's only one page to this exhibit, and you'll see on the left-hand side, the table is broken up by facility, and Alan is the first one there. And it lists the retired ash basin and then years during which CCR storage area was in operation, receiving or storing CCR. And do you see the dates there?
I do see it. My I'm having trouble. Honestly, the font's very small.
I think it's a lot easier to see on the screen when you can pull it up, but I apologize for that. But I'll
if you want to tell me what it is, I would concur, subject to check.
Absolutely. So it's 1957 to 1973.
Okay.
Okay. And so turning to the active ash basin, that impoundment began receiving sluiced ash in 1972. And again, that's on the spreadsheet, but if you want to confirm, subject to check.
Okay, subject to check, I would agree.
Okay. And is it correct that the groundwater data at Allen that was used for the Allen study and the R30 Little study was collected between 1979 and 1982? I believe you're muted, Mr. Wells.
I think my understanding is that the initial Allen study that was done, performed by the culminated in the Duke 84 report, that those wells went in. I think that those wells were installed in 78. So I think they began in 78.
Okay. So the active ash basin had been receiving coal ash for approximately 10 years when the groundwater monitoring was done. Is that right?
I don't remember the date in the report when the back end of the monitoring period for that supported the study.
And by comparison, if you look at, for example, Riverbend, which I believe was discussed yesterday as well, the two ash basins at Riverbend had been receiving sluiced coal ash since 1957. Isn't that right?
I believe that is correct. I believe it went into operation in 1957.
Okay. And that's all my questions.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Attorney General's office.
No questions, Chair Mitchell.
Okay. Sierra Club.
No questions, Chair Mitchell.
All right. Any other interveners? Questions on commissioners' questions? All right, Mr. Marzo.
Chair Mitchell, no redirect. I would ask at the appropriate time that the witnesses' exhibits be moved into the record.
All right, Mr. Marzo, if the company has no questions on commissioners' questions, and we will go ahead and move evidence into the record. You may begin. Make your motion, Mr. Marzo.
I would move, thank you, Chair Mitchell. I would move that the exhibits of Mr. Wells and Ms. Williams be moved into the record.
All right, the pre-filed exhibits of witnesses Wells and Williams will be admitted into evidence marked as they were when pre-filed. Any additional motions? I see.
Yes,
Ms. Townsend, you may proceed.
Thank you. We would move to admit AGO Wells Williams rebuttal cross-examination exhibits 1 and 2, please.
All right, hearing no objection to that motion, Ms. Townsend, it will be allowed.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Luhr.
Chair Mitchell, I would like to move that public staff Wells Williams rebuttal cross examination exhibit numbers 1 through 6 be entered into the record as marked.
All right, Ms. Luhr, hearing no objection to your motion, it will be allowed. All right, any additional procedural matters for my attention before we conclude?
Chair Mitchell, this is Kamal Robinson. I don't know if this is one of the ones that you're referencing, but we'd like to discuss, of course, the post-hearing brief and proposed order schedule, if this is an appropriate time or whether
Now is the time, Mr. Robinson. Please proceed.
Sure. So Chair Mitchell, I think at this time, obviously, and we really appreciate the court reporter being able to get our transcripts out timely. The company's proposal would be that we would submit our post-hearing brief and proposed orders within 30 days upon receipt of the final transcript or October 26th, whichever is a later date. And I would note that we have not discussed that with any of the parties, so the other parties will obviously need to weigh in. That is the company's proposal.
All right. Response from any of from counsel to Mr. Robinson's proposal? All right, then we will entertain proposed orders and briefs from the parties 30 days from the notice of the mailing of the transcript or October 26th, whichever is later. Any additional matters for my attention?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner McKissick.
Yeah, I did have one request for a late file exhibit, which would basically be a summarization of the way that Duke Energy computed its fulfillment fee in the contract termination dealing with Charlotte and how they also computed the fulfillment fee and a complete explanation of the differences between those computations. And that would be it. I know we discussed that what we're dealing with confidential information, so I'm trying to be respectful and not get into any numbers or anything of that nature, but it would be helpful to get that data. If there's need for clarity, I can provide it later. If there's a need for them to provide it confidential, that's fine too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Commissioner McKissick and Mr. Marzo, I believe those that request is directed at your witnesses. Any questions?
Chair Mitchell, I believe I understood the request. Okay. So I think we have that. It may need to be filed confidential, but Commissioner McKissick will allow that. So thank you.
All right. Well, at this point, we have come to the end of the DEC specific expert witness hearing. I want to express my appreciation for the hard work, counsel, that each of you has put into this case. We have been at this for a long, long time. You all have been at this for a very long time, and this has been an endeavor. So I want to thank you for your for hanging in there, for your hard work, for your professionalism, and for the rigor that you all have brought to this work. It is admirable and it's appreciated. I would like to thank the witnesses, those who are still on with us and those who are listening in. Thank you for your participation in this proceeding as well. And thanks to everyone out there who assists all of you in getting your work done. We would not be here right now. We wouldn't have been nearly as efficient and organized with our hearing time if we were not to have had their assistance. So with that, it is 11:13. We will be off the record. We are adjourned, and thank you very much, everyone.